Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman. And we have a very special guest with us tonight, Mr. Jay Stang. And trying to get my stream cut off. It came back on me and just had to get that shut down before I got any feedback going here. Red, are you there with us?
I am now.
Well, it sure is good to hear your voice tonight, Red. We are honored tonight to have you with us, especially after what you've been through here for the last few days. I don't know if you want to talk about that at all or not.
Not
but I
really.
Know that you... Okay. Good. And we won't. Jay Stang is on with us. Red, you know, you have a little history of the Stang family, so... Would you mind doing a little introduction for Jay tonight as far as who he, what his heritage is?
Well, you know, I have some very pleasant memories going back quite a few years to when Alan Stang had his radio talk show in the Southern California area. Alan was a very good radio man, of course, and he had been the voice for Liberty Lobby back many years ago because they were buying quite a few radio spots, and Alan was the voice of Liberty Lobby because his voice... was very good, a very good radio voice, and he could talk quite rapidly. That was his normal way, I would say, of talking is quite rapidly, and of course that's what Liberty Lobby liked about him speaking, because if they had a 5-minute blurb, why? He would get an awful lot in on that 5 minutes. And, of course, then Alan had that talk show in California, and I was his guest several times, and he was a very, very, very good talk show host. And he just, well, I think he had the highest rating of any talk show in the Southern California area, if I'm not mistaken. And I have a lot of memories of Alan Stang, and I was saddened, of course, to hear when he passed away here not too many months ago. So I'm just really pleased to be here tonight and see if he passed on to his posterity. To his son, did he pass on a lot of knowledge? And I'm sure he did. This is going to be a real exciting time for me tonight to get in on this. And so if I just listen, don't pick on me. I'll be listening. Terry, you're the one that's going to have to carry the ball here.
No problem.
You know, I'll be available if you need me. So with that, welcome to the show, Jay Stang, because you've got a heritage, and I hope you live up to it.
Thanks a lot, Red. Well, actually, I am Alan Stang. I'm Alan Stang Jr. So you can call me Alan if you want, but I've been known as Jay for most of my life.
Well, Jay, I
you
know
are Alan Stang Jr.?
Yes, yeah, Alan J. Stang Jr.
Oh, my. That's great.
And when he had his radio show on KIEV AM 870, he actually had twice as many listeners as Larry King did in 1996.
Yes, I remember that. And that was quite a feather in his cap as far as I was concerned. Larry King, of course, didn't hit the hot topics like your dad did. And so I think that's why he had the audience.
He also did not need suspenders to keep his pants up.
Well, Jay, yeah. Give the folks a little history on you. We know you've been a Marine for a couple of tours from the looks of it, and you're obviously a speaker for Tea Party events in big demand down in Texas, and you're an activist and also an Oath Keeper. And I'm sure you want to talk about Oath Keepers tonight, but we've got a lot to cover. And why don't you just give the folks a little taste of who Jay Stang is?
Well, if you've got the email, you can see the short bio that I put out for to Terry. I was born in Boston in 76, and the reason that we lived there, well, actually my parents lived in Nashua, New Hampshire, is because that's when my dad was working at the headquarters of the John Birch Society in Belmont, Massachusetts. So he wasn't going to live in Massachusetts, or Taxachusetts, as he called it. So we lived in New Hampshire, where the motto is live free or die. So we lived there for 2 years, and then my brother, that's 2 years younger than I am, Joseph, he was born in 78, and then in 78, we moved to Los Angeles, and then we stayed there until 1987. It was during this time my other two brothers and my sister were born. My sister's name is Paula. She is about 10 years younger than I am, and she's quite a rabid activist as well. In college, her nickname was Ron Paula. I think that one of her boyfriends gave that to her. Yeah, she's a Ron Paul person, par excellence. So we lived there until 1987, and right before we moved out of there is when the IRS came after my dad, and that's when I met Jeffrey Dickstein in 1987. But back then I was 11 years old, so he probably wouldn't recognize me if he saw me today. But in 1987, after my dad got back from vacation, he was on vacation for 6 months, then we moved to Texas for about 10 months, and then we moved to the Dominican Republic for a year and a half. So we all got to eat papayas and learn Spanish for that year and a half, which was a pretty good time. And then after that, then we moved back to Houston, and from there, we all, as soon as we turned 18, we all kind of scattered. My parents moved to Costa Rica for a year. They came back to watch me graduate from boot camp on August 2nd, 1996. Now, if you read the bio, it also says, and I like to include this fact, if you've seen Black Hawk Down, you know that on August 2nd, 1996, was the day that Mohamed Farah Aidi, the Soviet-trained Somali warlord, was killed. So it's kind of ironic that he was killed on the day that I became a Marine. So I like to put that in my cap as another kind of a feather as well. So then I served two tours in the Marine Corps for a total of about 9 years. And then in 2005, I separated. And before I got, my last duty station was Okinawa, Japan. So I was there for a year, and that's when I went to Thailand to do some relief work for the tsunami that hit December 2004. Before I got out, I started reading about the Minuteman Project. So I signed up to be a Minuteman from Okinawa. But then logistically, I wasn't able to make it, so I signed up when I got back to Texas. And almost as soon as I got back, I started doing work with the Minutemen. Then the Minutemen in South Texas turned into the Texas Border Volunteers over an SOP dispute between the South Texas Minutemen leader, Dr. Mike Vickers, and the Minutemen headquarters. The problem there was we weren't allowed to carry long guns on patrol. But we were tracking the coyotes who had AK-47s and Winchester 30-30 lever-action rifles. So we kind of thought, well, we need something better than our pistols. So we formed our own group where we could carry rifles while we were sneaking around in the bushes. So that was the start of my modern day activism in 2006. And then in 2009, I found out about Oath Keepers holding their first meeting in Lexington, Massachusetts. So I flew up to Lexington to be on the green on April 19th, 2009, and that's where we founded Oath Keepers. So now I'm a plank owner or founding member of Oath Keepers, as you could say. And from 2009 till about September of last year, I didn't hold a leadership position in the organization, but then they asked me to be vice president for most of Texas. So that's what I'm doing now. And then in November of last year, I organized the Houston We Won't Fly anti-TSA protest. That was a ton of fun, but I've read that as a result, I'm on a list of domestic extremists now, and I haven't tried to fly since then, so I'm not sure what would happen to me when I walk up to the gate. I'm going to have to test that out soon because I have to fly for business in the next few months. So that's going to be an adventure in and of itself. So I'm looking forward to matching wits again at the TSA at the gate or the ticket counter, whichever comes first. And then last year I spoke at the End the Fed rally in Houston. You can find that somewhere on the internet. It's too close to me speaking. So that is what I've been doing lately for the cause of liberty. Of course, I've got a lot to go, a long way to go. And if you can listen to the introduction from Red, I've got some big shoes to fill. So I'm doing my best in that respect, Red.
Well, that sounds good. That you have brought me up to date on some of the things that Alan was doing in his last years, and because you know, I hadn't heard much of him. I knew he had his IRS problems and all of that, and I knew that you had moved out. You said where you moved. No, I forgot it already. But you were offshore for a couple of years there, and it was well. Your dad, we didn't see much of his material, you know. At that point, it wasn't until he came back to the States that we started seeing. And of course, the internet, you know, they well, News with Views, they ran some of his writings and. Every time he had one in there, it brought back some very pleasant memories because I could almost hear him talk when I read his what he produced.
Yep.
And so I'm just thrilled to death that you're trying to pick up where your dad left off. Are you doing a great deal of writing or?
The only writing, the bulk of the writing I've done, Red, was for a public speaking class in junior college. So I took advantage of the opportunity to violently jar about 25 young impressionable minds with a little bit of an alternative perspective that they'd probably never heard before. So if you look on Scribd, scribd.com, if you just look me up, it's under my name. You can see everything I've written so far that I've posted on there. I might write more in the future, but for right now, writing really isn't, I don't know, a list of priorities, just because there's so much written material that comes out every day on the internet. If I feel like I have something incredibly unique to say, then I'll start writing, but until then, I don't want to clog the internet, the series of tubes that make up the internet any more than I have to. So if you look on Scribd, most of what you'll see are speeches or the texts of speeches that I've given, including the speech that I gave at the End of the Fed rally in November. You can find the text of that on Scribd, as well as a talk I gave at the Bastrop County Republican Women's Club that was in January of this year.
Well, Jay, you wanted to talk a little bit about those new initiatives going on at Oath Keepers.
Yes. Yes.
I'm anxious to hear that.
Okay. Well, for the first 2 years Oath Keepers was in existence, our focus was merely, you could say, the tactical level. And that would be, and by tactical, I mean talking to individual servicemen, policemen, and firefighters, and talking to them about the oath that everyone takes when they become a policeman, a firefighter, a member of the military. And then over and above that, a judge, a lawyer, a a representative, you know, any kind of government official, they all take an oath to the Constitution. Even the president takes an oath to the Constitution. Apparently, even if you take it more than once, it doesn't work any better than if you take it only one time. That's a little dig there. But we went around mainly for 2 years trying to get to as many active duty guys as we could, because our rationale was they're going to be the ones that will be given the orders, the unconstitutional orders, and so we want to get to these guys and educate them on the oath that they've taken, because it's possible and really sadly likely that a lot of people have taken the oath to the Constitution, never actually read it, and so they're swearing their lives to something that they don't know anything about. So we aimed to get to these guys and say, this is the oath, you've sworn an oath to the Constitution, this is what it means, and this is what you've obligated yourself to uphold. If you didn't know this before, now you know, welcome to the party. So Stuart had to take a few months off. Stuart Rhodes, the National Director of Oath Keepers, took a few months off last year to deal with some family issues. When he came back with a new policy initiative. And this is a little higher level thinking at the strategic level. And it goes like this. We've been trying to get these guys educated so that they will resist an unconstitutional order. But the problem arises when you look at the economic outlook of this country, it's not very bright. In fact, it's pretty bleak. We at Oath Keepers expect some form of economic collapse to happen. We don't know if it's going to happen quickly or slowly over the course of a couple of years or a day. We have no idea. I don't think anybody else really does either. So what we decided to do was to focus on two pillars that the states right now are resting on. Those two pillars are economic security and military security. What we mean by economic security, you've no doubt read about in the news of Utah and Virginia discussing setting up committees to explore alternatives to the dollar. The dollar as we know it today, the paper-backed fiat currency that the Fed puts out, which is rapidly approaching worthlessness. So we figured when this happens, economic chaos sets in, and you can find no shortage of post-apocalyptic writings and novels depicting America after an economic collapse. If the military looks out of America and sees a nation in utter and complete chaos, the military is going to feel less of a compulsion to resist an order, even if they know it's wrong, because they think, my hometown is burning down, my state is in chaos, Texas is, where I live in Texas is, going to H-E double hockey sticks and a handbag. I've got to do something about it. And so then when the commander says, we're going to go restore order, we're going to declare martial law in Houston, Texas, so people will stop killing each other, it's going to seem like a more attractive option to the individual serviceman to go save his state. Even if he may not agree with the means, he wants to see the end, which would be the restoration of order in the state come about. So we thought, well, we need to lessen the chances of that happening. So we're going to work with anybody we can, local officials all the way up to state legislatures, to get sound money reintroduced into the states. After all, the Constitution mandates that the states pay their bills with gold and silver. So this is the one leg of our new policy initiative. If we can even just at least get the ball rolling for people to start looking at going back to gold and silver, like we're supposed to be doing anyway, then we might be able to forestall, given an unknown amount of time that we have left, we might be able to forestall some degree of economic collapse. And so when a military guy looks out on America and sees these very beginning steps at security and at stability, he will be less tempted to follow an unconstitutional order and can assist in declaring martial law in any city or state in this country. And then the second portion of that, military security, goes hand in hand with the founder's original ideal for the conduct of military forces in this country. If you read the Constitution, an army is only authorized for 2 years at a time. The Navy is continually authorized. So if we only have an army for 2 years at a time, the space that is filled when the army is not actually called up is, of course, the militia. And when I say the militia, I'm talking about the real militia, which is part of the state government, not a private group. It's an interesting dichotomy. If you look at it, the militias that we see, or what they call themselves militias, they're made up of the members of the militia of the several states, that is able-bodied males 18 to 45. The members of these groups that call themselves militias are members of the militia, but the group itself is not a militia because it's a private group. The only thing that separates a modern-day private militia from MS-13 are goals and actions and intent. So the real militia is something like on April 19, 1775, Captain John Parker of the militia was not he didn't make himself a captain. He was made a captain by the state of Massachusetts. The militia that fired the shot heard around the world was part of the Massachusetts state government. Imagine, if you can, the state of Massachusetts declaring war on the country of Great Britain. It's a little hard to imagine, but that's exactly what happened. And so we need to work with county sheriffs, local officials, state representatives to reestablish the real militia. For example, in Texas law, the Texas State Guard, which is the remnant of that militia, is a small unarmed force. I really don't know what they do that can really do anything. They really aren't a skeletal framework for a massive call-up in case Texas needs to defend itself. In Texas law, it says the Texas State Guard is part of the Second Amendment militia, and then the other part of the Second Amendment militia is the reserve militia, which fulfills the constitutional requirement for a militia, able-bodied males 18 to 45. Now, there's no training or organization or any kind of structure or well-regulation that the Second Amendment requires. There's nothing like that existing in Texas law. So it appears to me from my reading of the law that the current plan is for Rick Perry, the governor, to issue the call-out to his adjutant general, and then the adjutant general filters the command down, and then a militia officer, a second lieutenant, will go to the mall, the gallery in Houston, Texas, with a bullhorn and say, "I'm now hereby ordering a militia call-up. All able-bodied male 18 to 45, you're part of the reserve militia. We're calling you to service." That's going to go over like a Led Zeppelin. Nobody's going to know what's going on, and it's not going to be a well-regulated militia. It's going to be craziness. So that plan really isn't a good plan. And so what we're trying to do is restore the actual practice of having a Second Amendment militia. And by Second Amendment, I mean part of the state government, reinstituting that. So if Texas starts experiencing this economic chaos and breakdown, Texas can call out the militia, and this would be U.S. or Texas citizens guarding their homes, their businesses, and their communities, which has much more legitimacy, even the National Guard troops coming in, because the National Guard has always been part of the federal government. Please don't be deceived. It was formed in 1903 by the Dick Act. It is not the constitutional militia, and that was never intended to be that. So those are the two planks of our new policy initiative, economic and military security.
Got a lot of background noise going here. Well, Jay, as you're aware, especially if you read my article that I sent you today,
yes,
I've been working somewhat with Dr. Edwin Vieira,
right,
and his more recent proposed legislation for sound currency or sound money actually has a provision in it for the state to revitalize its well-regulated state militia.
Yes, so for some reason those things just go hand in hand.
Yes, it does. And people don't really understand that, and I'm trying to educate people on that, and it's a challenge. So many people are like, you mentioned the word militia, and of course it's been so demonized,
right,
that they don't even want to see it in an article.
Right.
They're afraid the publishers or editors are going to get a bad reputation,
mm-hmm,
or something.
Right.
And I frankly am pretty sick of this this political correctness or fear that's going on out there. And I'm kind of up to my eyebrows,
right,
with that kind of mentality and pretty well disgusted with it. And on this show, we're not afraid to talk about those kind of things. We talk about them in a proper context. We've
right.
had Edwin on here, and he's actually, given a very detailed description of what a well-regulated state militia is. And, when people start understanding that those that those militia were organized through the Black Robe Regiment. They were organized through the churches.
Mm-hmm.
By definition, a well-regulated state militia is the citizenry itself, organized
yes.
from the grassroots level up. By definition, there's no such thing as a top-down militia. It is a grassroots organization. Now, yes, it's subject to the call of a governor or
right.
perhaps a county sheriff, but it's not organized by them. The officers within a militia are elected by the people that are in the militia, by the members of the militia itself, which, again, it's not just a military group or a group that's trained to fight, but it includes the butchers and the bakers and the ladies that are sewing the uniforms. And, you know, it includes everybody, really, when it boils right down to it. It is the Citizens Homeland Security, and that was, of course, Constitutional Homeland Security was one of the books that Edwin Vieira wrote. But
right.
so people don't recognize that the Second Amendment is not just about bearing arms. It states in there there's a word in the Second Amendment that doesn't appear anywhere else in the Constitution, and that
That's
is
necessary.
The word necessary. But what is necessary? It's not. It doesn't say that bearing arms is necessary. It says that the well-regulated state militia is necessary for the security of a free state.
Right. Yes, I agree with that completely, because if you look at history, the military has always been under the command of the sovereign, the monarch, whoever is in charge. And so now if you look at that modern day application of that, the false choice to a country in turmoil is either get rid of its government completely or ask the military to step in. The two are a false choice. And the third way that the founders locked onto was to keep the military power in the hands of the people. There's a quote by one of the founding fathers. I can't remember who said it, but it says, "The sword and every other terrible implement of the soldier is the birthright of every American. Keeping the military power in the hands of the people is the best way to ensure that tyranny cannot succeed in this country."
Absolutely. What's your knowledge of Vieira's Sound Money plan of his?
I have not read his Sound Money plan. I've mainly studied his militia writings. A couple of years ago, I was looking at trying to start. I was educating myself in the process, and at first I called it a militia, but then I read, did some intense reading. I realized, no, the militia has to be part of the state government, and the compromise that I eventually settled on would be called the Citizens Auxiliary. And my local sheriff and I in Fort Bend County in Texas talked about it several times, and he gave me the go-ahead to start organizing it. Unfortunately, I couldn't get a lot of interest from some of the residents of the county, so it really never took off. But the important part in my mind was that I was able to successfully talk to the sheriff and get his approval to start forming one. And by the way, that's what people all over this country can do. You might have more success with a rural sheriff than an urban sheriff, but talk to your sheriffs. See if they've heard of, Richard Mack, who's also on the Oath Keepers Board of Directors. See if they've heard of him. See if they've read his book or if they know about the Supreme Court case that he was involved in. And talk to them about forming your own citizens auxiliaries. Because especially during natural disasters, that's the easiest way to broach the subject. In natural disasters, the sheriff's department and every other law enforcement department is going to be critically shorthanded. And so having responsible, sober-minded citizens to step into the gap can be a lifesaver for some of these sheriff's departments. Plus, the sheriff's department is a constitutional department, and the sheriff, if he's doing his job, can really come into his own and restore a lot of freedom in the county that you live in.
Well, indeed. The county sheriff's is an interesting situation, and our friend, mutual friend, I'm sure you know David Helms.
I've never met him, but I know of him.
Okay, well, I was fortunate to be at Continental Congress with David. So it was actually, I don't know if Red met him, but I know that Dr. Kate, who's producing the show tonight and is listening, and certainly could come on here anytime she likes. we got to know David pretty good and stayed in touch with him up until just a few months ago. And he is obviously has been a board member and head of Arkansas's.
Yes, yeah, he's a state director for Arkansas for Oath Keepers.
Oath Keepers. And I'm trying to remember what the point was that I started talking about him about. I got to thinking about David, and it got my mind pulled away. But at any rate, Oath Keepers and the county sheriff situation, you wanted to talk about that. You mentioned Sheriff Mack, but David did some checking on county sheriffs down on the Gulf Coast during the Gulf oil crisis, which really is not over. It's just been somewhat forgotten. But when David did some checking on the sheriffs down there, he found that there was a bunch of sheriffs that had actually abdicated their authority to FEMA. And I know that shocked him and me and everybody else that heard that, but that just kind of blew my mind that these sheriffs didn't have any more knowledge of what their authority and power and responsibilities were than to abdicate that authority to the feds, because –
right.
That's totally contrary to the whole state sovereignty concept.
Yes. But the problem is if you don't know what your rights are, you don't know when they're going to be taken away from you. And if you don't know what's in the Constitution, you won't know when it's being trampled. Ignorance is bliss to a point, but ignorance can also be very deadly.
Well, what's your recommendation for people? How should we be dealing with our county sheriffs? What do local people need to be doing? Because that's one of the things that everybody that's really an activist should know.
Well, I think the first thing you have to realize, where do you live? If you live in Marin County or Los Angeles County, you're probably not going to get very far. But if you live in a county, like I said, with a rural sheriff, you're going to be more likely to find someone who at least will listen to what you have to say. The first thing to do is, you know, find out what kind of sheriff you have, and just kind of, if you can get and if you can sit down and talk to him, find out, you know, what his positions are about certain things, what he thinks is important. You know, if he's read the Constitution, if he has a copy of Richard Mack's book. I mean, I'm working up the scale of knowledge here for a sheriff. But find out where your sheriff is on that continuum of constitutional education. And if he is at the bottom, don't yell at him and say, you're ignorant and you're an enemy of the people. Offer to help him, to educate him on his proper constitutional role. Work on the self-interest. Sheriffs don't know that they have a lot more power than they do, constitutional power, and say, sheriff, do you know that as a sheriff, you are empowered to do all these things. You can keep federal agents out of your county. You can impact the lives of your citizens in a positive way. Most sheriffs probably don't know the power that they possess. They might think that they're just another cog in the machine of law enforcement, but they're really not. They're not a city police chief. They're an elected sheriff. In Houston, in Texas, we have constables, which are also elected officials, and the constable has the unique authority in that he is the only person in Texas who can arrest a sheriff. So I would say to get in front of your sheriffs, let them know who you are, and find out where they are and offer to help them. And if they reject your help, there's not much more you can do except run for sheriff yourself.
Well, I believe that this is a critically important thing, and people take the sheriff's elections, for example, for granted. And
right.
And people in the liberty movement should be very aware of who's running for sheriff, and they should be very
yes.
careful about who they vote for. And if they're not
right.
confident that their local sheriff is going to stand up for their constitutional and unalienable rights,
I
shouldn't have said constitutional. I meant stand up for the Constitution and the people's unalienable rights, which came from our Creator, mm-hmm. not the Constitution.
Right. That's a very important point.
And we need sheriffs that are going to stand up against the federal government, who are going to be willing to say, I don't give a rip about your federal funds. You know, so many of these guys are interested in getting more dollars into their county, and will give up and surrender their own authority in order to get those dollars. And we need sheriffs
yes.
to understand that our rights are more important than those federal dollars.
Yes, I think it's more important to actually be active in the process of selecting a new sheriff instead of standing outside with signs. That's important, but the real change can be made when you can influence who the next sheriff is going to be in your county. Don't just sit back and let another sheriff's election go by. Get out there, see who's a worthy candidate, and if there aren't any worthy candidates, band together and find someone who is and convince them to run or run yourself. There's no reason why we can't start taking some of these local offices because you know, it's hard to get elected as one of the senators from the state. Very hard to do. The entrance fee is a few million dollars just to get started. But there's no reason why we can't run for sheriffs. There's no reason why we can't run for city councilman, county commissioner, court. A lot of these offices are not too hard to get.
A while ago, you mentioned motivating oath keepers to resist following unconstitutional orders. It's kind of hard to think about that without thinking about Terry Lakin.
Right, right. And you know, I've followed his case very closely. And I think the tack on that that needs to be taken is that the British Nationality Act of 1948, by its very passage and its very existence, makes Barack Obama a British citizen because his father was a British citizen of Kenya, and the Nationality Act of 1948 says anybody born to a British father is a British citizen. So we really have a British citizen occupying the Oval Office. But what Lieutenant Colonel Lakin didn't do, he didn't stress that because it may very well be that Obama was born in Honolulu. It very well could be. The correct tack to take is that his father was a British citizen and conferred his British citizenship upon Obama when he was born. But the thing that he did that there's a lot of pressure to obey orders, unimaginable pressure. And so even getting as far as he did, You can't criticize him. The only thing I wish he had done a little differently, though, is he should not have apologized at the end of his court-martial. I mean, it's easy to be an armchair quarterback, but apologizing at the court-martial gave the impression that now Terry Lakin knows that he was wrong the whole time and he should never have questioned the questioned authority and should never have done what he did. I would much rather that he had stayed firm all the way to the end and never apologize for making the stand. But then again, you know, getting to that position where he was took a lot of guts to begin with. So I definitely applaud him for that. And I hope that when he gets out, he can start to rebuild his life for him and his family.
Jay, I want to introduce you to our wonderful host here at Revolution Radio, Dr. Kate. Dr. Kate actually attended the Lakin trial, and has had the privilege of speaking directly with Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin, and she is live speaking to you right now.
Good evening, Dr. Kate.
Oh, good evening. Thank you for joining us on Walls in Our Minds, and I wanted to tell you how anguished those of us who were there in the courtroom were to see not only Terry Lakin's own defense attorney totally crush him on the stand. That apology was not necessary, but I'm telling you, he was executed in the courtroom by his own attorney.
And I forgot to mention his substandard lawyer didn't do him any favors.
And not only that, of course, but all of that evidence was not even allowed.
Right.
But in the beginning, when he did this, he did not get the advice, as you pointed out, he did not get the advice to go on British nationality, and that would have been
yes.
a very easy way to go, and so forth. So it was all on that birth certificate. So I completely agree with you. And in hindsight, it just looks like an enormous setup and railroading of this guy. I do think that it was intended to stop forever. This question, especially among the armed services, because his sentence was 3 days before Christmas and so forth and so on. So, but I just did want to tell you and the listening audience that Terry Lakin was forced to do that, and I guess it would be like this. You know, you're surrounded by your enemy and you don't have any bullets left.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And but if there was a, and what I understand from Terry is that he did not expect this. It was not expected. But this was sprung on him while he was on the chair, on the stand. It was brutal. And I will never, ever forget that betrayal, ever. And I just wanted to give you the sense of that, that there's no way, and I know no one is blaming Lakin at all, but if there is blame to be held for any apology of for orders, he was absolutely railroaded by his own people. The army failed him. And I just have to say, what kind of natural-born citizen commander-in-chief would ever do that to his own men? What kind of commander-in-chief would ever do that to his own men? So Lakin really took not only one bullet, but a million bullets for all of us.
Yes.
But it didn't knock us down. So in any
case,
I just want to just reinforce that and just share with you something of what I saw, because I can hear your concern about him and your discussion, and just wanted to share that view with you. Thanks
Thank
for
you,
the
Dr. Kate, Dr. Kate, before you go, and I'll actually, if it's okay, I'd like to let Jay make his comments and finish his discussion with you. But before you go away, I'd like for you to talk about Dr. Kate's view and let people know, you know, that they can get in on this discussion and follow everything that's going on with the eligibility stuff and really get a lot of good constitutional education regarding the eligibility and natural-born citizenship at drkatesview.wordpress.com. So you can repeat that in a minute. But, Jay, now I'll shut up and let you talk.
Oh, I was just going to say that I appreciate her perspective because I wasn't in the courtroom, and so I did not see firsthand what happened. All I know is from what I've read, and so I'm very – very glad to hear some eyewitness testimony on what actually happened inside the courtroom.
Yeah, it was devastating, I would say. Devastating.
Yes.
And yeah. Terry, I'm just going to put up a link to my latest article today, which basically kind of busts Karl Rove on this natural-born citizen issue. And just also want to remind everybody about at that Terry Lakin trial, I don't know if you've ever followed the work of Reverend James David Manning, who did the Columbia CIA trial. But
oh, yes.
Reverend Manning,
yes, I know about him.
So, right, Reverend Manning was also at the trial, and he was arrested along with other people there, along with his staff.
For trespassing,
yes.
The second day they let him in.
Yes, through the same exit. It was completely trumped up. Need I
yes.
say he was the only black man in the room and his staff.
Well,
and
it
was absolutely designed to just make a circus and to, you know, show up, have all these cars and police people out there, and definitely designed for intimidation. And
well, you know, I'm
I am,
thinking of the other way around. They needed all those people there. They're obviously scared that something's going to happen, and
right.
so they want to. I mean, they're bullies, basically, overgrown playground
yep.
bullies.
That's right. So this whole thing was designed to scare anybody who raised this issue right before Christmas. So,
right.
you know, just so basically it was to shut up. But you are at, I again want to go back to the whole concept of natural born citizen, which is what my blog is about, and the Constitution. And you're all welcome to read there. I've got a lot of materials there. But that this was all designed to not get at the essential issue. Look, the guy's a Brit. The British Nationality
right.
Act, that is basically the thing. So it was the entire birth certificate. But, you know, I got the distinct impression when I was in the courtroom that, and from the readings of both attorneys, that they don't believe that concept. And it's, in my view, you don't have a choice whether you believe it or not until there's a Supreme Court decision beyond the 1857 decision or... The Constitution is amended. You don't have any choice.
That's right.
The dual
yeah.
citizen at best. And that's
if
not a lot.
If you agree with it, change the Constitution. Don't ignore it.
Exactly. You don't change it by fiat. You know,
right,
that's not the
right
way we're supposed to do it. So anyway, my apologies for interrupting your excellent discussion, and thank you for sharing stuff on Lakin. But there's a lot more to what happened at that trial and Terry Lakin, and I just wanted to share that experience with you. It's not something
well,
I would wish on anybody, but I'm really glad I witnessed it.
Well, I think when Lieutenant Colonel Lakin gets out of the brig, hopefully he'll write a book giving us all the details, his memoirs, basically. I'm sure that would go a long way towards helping him provide for his family, because I'm sure that his medical license has probably been burned in a nuclear reactor by now, so he'll never be able to practice
mm-hmm.
medicine again. So he might as well be on the board of a conservative or patriotic organization, continuing the fight from there.
Yep. Well, we're all going to make sure he's taken care of forever, I think, because this is what you do for your soldiers. You do
yes.
not let them
yes.
rot in jail just because you don't have the you-know-what to say anything.
Right, and that's the, I think the VA's original mission was to him that is born the burden of battle. And if we're going to expect these guys to get out there and do battle for us, then when they suffer and they're shot by the enemy, you can't just let them lie there. You have to pick them up and carry on.
Yep, you do. So there we go. So thank you so much for your service, and thanks for coming on. And thank you, Terry and Red, for it. Red, hello there. I hope you feel much, much better. My mom had a similar incident this weekend, and so I know how tired you must be, but thank you for being here. Thank you again. I'll just sign off now. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for contributing, Kate, and you're always welcome on here, and we love it when you come on, and you always enhance the show. You're never interrupting, so don't ever apologize to me again for that, please.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Well, Jay, I'm curious to know what Oath Keepers is doing on an ongoing basis to make Terry Lakin's case more public and educate people as to what he's going through and why.
Stuart has written a few articles on Lieutenant Colonel Lakin. If I forgive my memory, we were probably doing a lot more during the trial, but we definitely publicized it while the trial was going on, and we have a discussion forum that was the hot topic for quite a while. When he gets out of the brig and resumes normal life, I'm sure that we'll have more to do with it. But for right now, Oath Keepers has put the word out and kept people informed as best we can. There's been so much conservative media coverage of the trial already that anybody who, you know, travels in our media circles is going to know about it. But one thing we are working on a lot of things. One thing we're working on is setting up an Oath Keepers legal defense arm where we can recruit lawyers who are Oath Keepers to both serve to do pro bono legal work, and also trying to establish a legal defense fund that people can contribute to when military members do what we ask them to do and refuse an order, because it's guaranteed that if you refuse an order, you're going to be court-martialed, your name's going to be dragged through the dirt, you're going to be put in pretrial confinement, they're going to make your life as horrible as possible to get you to break and to recant your heretical beliefs. So we're trying to set up a fund so that we can back these guys up when they do what we ask them to do.
It looks like Kate's got a message on 207 Live. Who's area code 207? Are you, if you're there, say hello. Well, they're either not there or don't know to speak up. Red, we've been talking so long, and I just want to make sure you're there and listening to this.
Well, I'm enjoying this program immensely because I think Jay is going to be walking in his father's shoes here, if he isn't already. I would like to say for the Terry Lakin thing, and the birth certificate and all of that, I think that, excuse me, I think that what I've been saying for a long time is that we need a grand jury someplace in the country, I don't care where it's at, if we had a grand jury that put out a summons for, you know, Barry Obama or whatever you want to call him, to appear before the grand jury. Bill Clinton, he didn't think he'd have to appear before the grand jury, and of course he was an attorney, and he should have known better, but he tried to defeat that summons to the grand jury. He wanted a judge to quash the subpoena, and it didn't work. The grand jury, all they would have to do is subpoena Al Obama to show up before the grand jury, and they would order that he bring his birth certificate. And I think that that would be the end of the case right there. Very simple. But that's the way the system was designed. It was designed very simple. And it was designed so that the people at our level, and that's the people on the grand jury, at our level have the sovereign position where they can order the President of the United States to appear before them and bring the evidence of his natural-born status. And he can't do that. We know that. And you know, there is a simple way around this, and there's too many attorneys that got involved in the Terry Lakin trial, and they didn't ask me. they didn't want to ask me about what I thought because they already knew what I thought, and they were going to make sure that nobody said anything like what I'm saying right now. That's the solution to this whole problem of having an alien sitting in the Oval Office. So,
you're talking about a presentment.
What?
You're talking about a presentment that is mentioned in the Fifth Amendment.
Well, you see, no, I wasn't talking about that at all. You see, the grand jury has this tremendous investigative report or power. And if they were to call Obama to the grand jury to testify as to his pedigree, I think that you would find that Obama would be on his way out of the country. He's not going to expose himself. He would rather just get the U.S. The Air Force One to fly him. I think they ought to give him a parachute and let him jump out over Kenya. And that's kind of far out, I know. But
let me try to clarify what the two of you are saying. Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I believe Red's point, Jay, is that even before a grand jury would get to a presentment, which is simply a self-generated indictment, one that was not granted based on a bill of indictment from a judge, a sitting judge, but if the grand jury goes rogue, even before they would issue a presentment, they would have subpoena power. And they have every right to investigate anything and everything they deem fit within their jurisdiction. They can subpoena.
They can have a press conference, and the powers that be today, they say, "Oh, the grand jury proceedings are all secret." That if they say it's secret, they say that for a reason, and that it's the wrong reason. And the grand jury has the right to communicate with their fellow Americans about what's going on. And you see, we had a presidential commission investigate the Kennedy assassination and the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City and 9/11. They were all political commissions that were put together they were handpicked by the President of the United States. And you see, it should have been grand jury proceedings on all of them. All of those cases should have been investigated by a grand jury, because the grand jury has more power than a presidential commission. And that's your sovereignty. That's where your sovereignty argument comes in, is who's sovereign here? The grand jury, or a government position that's made up with a bunch of politicians. Those people all have a conflict of interest if they're part of government.
Well, I thought that's what I was referring to when I mentioned presentment, is that the grand jury is not operating off of instructions from the district attorney, but decides on their own that they will start to investigate whomever and whatever they want to.
They can do that because of their sovereign position. Nobody in government has any authority whatever to tell the grand jury how to operate. None whatever. And we've got to educate our people in this country about what it means to be sovereign. They talk about sovereignty, the Tea Party people and all the rest, they talk about sovereignty, but they really don't understand how this sovereignty is supposed to function.
I think it's a process they have to go through where they've never heard of it before, then they throw the word around, and then people start to actually study what it means in the history in this country, and they have to teach themselves what is really going on. And so I think that it's just got to take some time for people to educate themselves and become knowledgeable in words like sovereignty and presentment and the constitutional sheriff and all these other, and militia, all these issues that have really been demonized and maligned in popular media.
Yeah, well, the grand jury, we've got some grand juries, federal grand juries, all over this country. In the situation of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, one of the grand jury members was asking too many questions, and they booted him off of the grand jury. I had to make a special trip over there to Oklahoma City and meet with the fellow, because they were really threatening him with criminal prosecution and everything else. And I went over and met with him, and I told him, I said, don't you worry. They are not going to start a criminal proceeding against you. They don't dare, because some of the best attorneys in the United States of America would want in on that argument, because I'm not alone saying what I'm saying.
Right.
There's some very good attorneys out there that understand what I have said, and I understand what they're saying. Most of them, of course, they don't have the backbone to come out and speak out like they should because of their law license and that type of thing. But this is where the remedy is to the Obama situation. And eventually I hope that we get a grand jury someplace. They can be any place in the United States. They don't have to be in Washington, D.C. They can be in, clear across the country. But it's something that it could happen. We had a grand jury in Salt Lake 20 years ago or better that indicted the Federal Reserve Bank twice. And both times, the one time the U.S. attorney just dismissed it, and the second time it was a federal judge who quashed the indictment. And, of course, neither the U.S. attorney or the judge had the authority to do what they did, but they were hoping that they could get away with it because the grand jury, they weren't up to speed, really, on how much power they had. But now that we're having the sovereignty arguments all over the United States, our chances of getting a grand jury that will function properly are getting better every day.
Oh, yeah, more people are learning about what's going on. Yeah, the more people learn, the more people, I mean, even the Tea Parties, even the Fox News type Tea Parties are having an impact just to get people talking about some topics and concepts that haven't been addressed in 100 years. So even the slightest bit of activism on our part can help the situation. And then if you go to the other end of the spectrum to get the really constitutionally based Tea Party groups like the Hill County Tea Party up in Hillsboro, Texas, then you really start to see some effectiveness, because those Tea Party groups that are constitutionally oriented and are studying the Constitution can really, they have the power of numbers, and so they can educate massive amounts of people on things like jury nullification and presentments and, you know, what the grand jury can do. So, Red, I think it's just a matter of time, and not very long at all, before we see some real constitutional grand juries reach a critical mass in this country. Because
I'm in full agreement on that, and I'm having trouble waiting for it, but I've waited a long time now, so I can wait a little longer.
We're at the end of our first hour, and we're going to take a little break here for just about 2.5-3 minutes, and we will be right back with Jay Stang, Red Backman, and Terry Dodd on Walls in Our Minds.
You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor, or they may call you chief. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a state trooper, it may be a young turk, maybe the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman, and our special guest tonight, Jay Stang. You guys were talking about serving on a jury and being fully informed and people understanding that they have the right to judge the law, and I didn't want to interrupt that conversation because it's very important. Who wants to go?
I was just going to say before we hit the break is that my wife got a federal grand jury summons in the mail about a week ago. The only bad part about that is she is probably going to be giving birth to our second son about the time that that jury summons is going to be in effect. So no grand jury service for Mrs. Stang.
Well, tell her she's just going to have to wait till after jury duty, either that or go in and get it done now so she can serve.
Well, you know, I told her that too, because I was trying to get on the fourth season of Top Shot on the History Channel, but she wasn't in favor of being pregnant for another 5 months, so... Yeah.
I don't want to be insensitive here, but we need somebody on one of those grand juries that knows they can judge the law and that they have the right to investigate anything they want. Boy, that's pretty.
Well, I was wondering why they couldn't have sent me the summons. That would have been a great day.
Yes,
I would have treasured that.
One of our regular guests on Walls in Our Minds, Elo Jones, who's the director of Fully Informed Jury Association. And, of course, Jay, you may not know that, but I'm sure your dad did, that Red Beckman inspired that group to be formed.
I didn't know that Red was involved in the Fully Informed Jury. or I don't know. I saw a lot of flyers go through my house when I was a kid, but I do know that Red Road, The Law That Never Was. I think I have a couple copies inbound to me at this time.
Yeah, well, the first time that I had contact with Larry Dodge and Don Doig, and Don Doig, of course, is one of your people in Montana with Oath Keepers. The first time they heard what I was saying was 1979, December of 1979. They had the first modern-day libertarian state political convention in Missoula, Montana. And I was invited to as a speaker, and I spoke and then left. And then over the years, I had a certain amount of contact with those two fellows. They were great friends at that time, and they're not really all that friendly, I guess, with each other today for some reason. But anyway, Don Doig, of course, is still one of the directors of FIJA. But every time we crossed trails, of course, why I stressed what I was saying about the juries and such, and it was not until 1989 that the idea of putting together an organization, a national organization, promoting jury nullification and just an educational deal, an educational company or whatever you would call it, a gathering of people. And so it took 10 years for it to really soak in. Of course, I was asked at different times to be a director, and I said, no, I have my own program and get other people involved, and that's what they've done. And they've done a great job. Larry Dodge isn't there. He had a lot of health problems. But it's an organization I'm very proud of.
Well, 10 years was the amount of time between the Stamp Act and Lexington and Concord, 1765 to 1775. So you're in good company, Red. Some ideas take a little while to percolate.
I've had that happen a number of times across the country where people would hear a presentation and then, you know, they would let that thing germinate. And finally, after 10 years, then they jump in with both feet and become a real promoter of jury nullification. So it's not unusual. It's just that right now we don't have time. We can't be taking 10 years to educate the Tea Party people and such.
Right.
We've got to help them leapfrog ahead. We don't want them having to go through the process of reinventing the wheel. I think we're going after that pretty strong here in just the next few weeks with some DVDs that are going to hopefully they'll go viral, and I think they will. Lord willing that I get this done before I cash out here. But anyway, somebody can do it. If I'm out of the way, there's going to be somebody that's going to be able to fit in my shoes and carry on.
Well, I think in Houston, the fully informed jury head is either a guy named Mike Barre or Kathy Glass's husband. I can't remember his name, but one of the two guys, they kind of look alike. Either one of those guys is head of the Fully Informed Jury Association here in Houston.
There's an attorney down there by the name of Clay Conrad. He was part of the organization at one point, but he was a lawyer. And lawyers don't really fit in with Fully Informed Jury Association. He wrote a pretty decent kind of a book even about fully informed juries. And I haven't heard, Clay Conrad was his name, I haven't heard anything about him. So I don't know if he's still got a war going with the
establishment because of what he knows or not. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I haven't heard his name in the local circles here in Houston, so I don't know if he's active.
Well, have you heard the name Michael Menz?
Yes.
Michael Menz is, I think he's the best attorney in the United States, and he understands this concept very well. Of course, he's very successful in the courtroom, but he has taken some cases pro bono and defended some patriots and done a great job. But he's in the Houston area. I don't talk to him very often because he is usually so very, very busy.
Right. Okay, Red, I just found his card. Yes, it's Tom Glass, and he's married to Kathy Glass, who was a Libertarian nominee for governor last cycle. And he is a lawyer, and he is head of the Fully Informed Jury Association of Texas.
Uh-huh. I don't know him, but we had a FIJA convention. I think that was in Dallas, if I remember right, Dallas or Houston. I don't remember where it was. And there was quite a representation there of lawyers. And of course, they had a special kind of seminar for attorneys. And they videotaped it all so that lawyers around the United States could get credit for watching those videos, get credit for their continuing education obligations. And I think Clay Conrad had much to do with getting it so that those videotapes were accepted as course for lawyers to take to learn about jury nullification.
Well, I think that's pretty necessary. I haven't been running with the FIJA crowd too much, so I can't really speak to what they're doing in Houston, but I know they're active.
I recommended right in the beginning that they not form a large national organization, a top-heavy organization, and that each state organization would be autonomous. They're still maintaining that modus operandi, I guess you'd say, and it's that way all across the country. In some states, they have some really active people. Right at the present, they have some very active people in the state of Florida. They're having some confrontations there with a particular judge and this type of thing. But for the most part, they've done a great deal on very, very few bucks, and they haven't had the money. But I can tell you right now that this year, in the past year, has been the best for FIJA financially. They've been able to do a lot more. So I just recommend anybody that's listening to this to go to their computer and Google it up and just say Fully Informed Jury, and I think they'll get the site for the Fully Informed Jury, because they do have a good web page.
Red, I think every time one of us sneaks onto a jury and happens to mention it and gets kicked off by the judge or says you are not allowed to listen to that, that's striking from your mind, obviously that's not struck from their minds. You got to wonder how many people begin to start wondering, what is this guy talking about, a fully informed jury? And so even if you get kicked off a jury, if you can throw that out there and get people's minds turning, and then if you can even get in a jury room, then you can really cause some damage to Leviathan.
Yeah.
Jay?
Is that Terry?
Yes, it is. Jay, are you familiar with the name of a Supreme Court justice by the name of Samuel Chase?
Yes, vaguely familiar. I've heard of him before.
Red, would you like to tell the story, or do you want me to?
Samuel Chase was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He had served his country well, and as a result, he was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court as judge. He was not the chief judge, but he was a judge.
Right.
And at that time, they didn't have that much case business to do, and so the judges would go out and preside over trials in the area, and Sam Chase went out and presided over a trial, and in his instructions, he told the jury, he said, you judge the facts, I'll judge the law. And
yes.
there was such an outrage. When they started, they filed articles of impeachment. They passed articles of impeachment in the House, which was like an indictment, and so he had to go to trial before the U.S. Senate. And the only thing that kept Sam Chase from being, found guilty was he got up before the U.S. Senate, and his testimony, I have read it, and it's really significant. He said, everybody knows that the jury has the right to judge the law and as well as the fact. And he just barely missed being impeached by the Senate, but he was he was not a young fellow anymore. He was up in years, but he retired into disgrace because of what he had done. Now, what we must do in this country is get back to that point where everybody knows that
right.
The jury has the right to judge the law as well as the fact, and they don't have to enforce that law. And, of course, I like to remind people, the Constitution gives no enforcement power whatever to anybody in government. All enforcement power was reserved to we the people. And I think that's a total surprise to most people. But we need to get that message out to the American people.
I agree with that 100%, Red.
I'm just looking at a conversation in the chat room right now, and I was just responding to it. you know, it's really important for people, and this is one of the things they teach you from Fiji. And I think it's worth talking about again and again on the show, so I'm gonna mention it. And that is that if you get on a jury, you need to be sleuth. You need to be recognizing what you should and shouldn't say until
yes.
you're actually selected for jury duty.
Be wise as a serpent.
If they find out you know the law, or they find out that you understand what your rights are, you're out of there. And,
Terry,
and
if
some
I can
people say,
you
well,
1 second, how do you get to the chat room?
Just go to the link that I sent you.
Okay.
It's blogtalkradio.com/Dr. Kate. And from there, you can actually see the Walls in Our Minds show.
Right.
blogtalkradio.com, Dr. Kate, and then hit the Walls in Our Minds show link, and it'll open it up.
Okay.
That should work that way anyway, I hope. At any rate, the point was one of our guys right here in Colorado, that's a friend of mine actually, was talking about the fact that he acknowledged to them that it says that the Constitution was written for lawyers. Are not written for lawyers. It was written for the people so that the common man or woman would understand their form of government. And he said he was the first one to be stricken from the jury pool. Well, I've had a lot of people ask me, you know, they say, well, I don't want to lie. You know, if they ask me a question, I'm not going to lie. And I ask them, I said, you know, you think it's a, you probably think it, that all lies are a sin, right? And they go, well, you know, they pretty much acknowledge, yeah, lies a sin. Well, I said, okay, if you're in Germany during World War II and you've got a family hiding under a floor, your floorboard, and the SS comes to the door and asks you, and you're sitting there with your family in the house, and this other family's hiding downstairs because they're hiding from the SS, they don't want to go to the gas chambers, and the SS comes to your door and ask you if you've got anybody else in your house, what are you going to do? And if you tell them no, Do you think God's going to condemn you to hell for that? I mean, come on, people. I mean, it really boils down to, you know, learning to at least be a little bit sleuth. I mean, you've got to be willing to get yourself into that jury pool, because you have a right to be on that jury, and you have a right to judge the law. And if you acknowledge that before you're selected, you're gone.
Right.
Let me insert something here. We had a fellow in Montana that was a political activist, and he got a notice to serve on the jury in the district court for the state of Montana. And he knew that there was no way, because of his reputation and all, there was no way that he could get on that jury. But he was supposed to report, and he would report, but he would go early. He'd be the first one there. And he'd have a handful of those brochures from FIJA. And as the different people would come in, they would go to the jury collection room or whatever they called it, and he would hand them a couple of these flyers. Well, they'd sit there and read them. And he never did get called for jury duty, but he was there every time. I don't know if it ever had an effect on any trial, but he had something that he could do, and he did it. And so we've got to be looking for opportunities to do whatever we can.
Well, gentlemen, we've got about 38 more minutes left in the show, and Jay, you mentioned a while ago, if you don't mind shifting gears for just a minute, you mentioned that you spoke at the End the Fed rally in Houston.
Yes, I think it was November 20th of last year.
How about giving us a taste of what you said?
Well, I was invited to speak as the Vice President of Oath Keepers, so I tailored my remarks to join the two topics together, and if you know, at first thought, you might not think, well, what does the Federal Reserve have to do with Oath Keepers? But it actually does have a lot to do with it. And one of the points is that the Federal Reserve, of course, is unconstitutional. So, you know, it being unconstitutional, someone has to vote for it and sign it into law. So whoever is, the congressmen, the senators, and House members that voted for that bill were not following the oath that they took to the Constitution. Because the Constitution says Congress has the power to coin money and the states shall pay their debts in gold and silver. So in order to vote for the Federal Reserve, you have to willingly break your oath that you've taken to the Constitution. So what I did was point out this fact that anybody who voted for the Federal Reserve Act was violating their oath to the Constitution, and their names need to be exposed and needs to be studied so we can remember them with in disgrace instead of them being an honorable, you know, so-and-so member of Congress in 1913. I'm looking for the speech right now. I can read you a little bit of it, but that is it in a nutshell.
Well, you read what I wrote in that article that I sent you today, and yes. I want to bring out something that I got from Red Beckman. Red's got a little book of the I think it's what, the 100 greatest speeches of Alfred Lawson. Red.
Yes.
Well, let me give it a little bit of background. In 1895, there was a landmark Supreme Court case. Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust Company. And in that case, they found the Income Tax Act of 1894, the Supreme Court ruled that the unapportioned income taxes were deemed a direct tax and not apportioned and therefore unconstitutional. So that Supreme Court case nullified the Income Tax Act of 1894. And then the Morgan and Carnegie had this lawyer that had represented them during this scandal of the 1890s, where Carnegie and Morgan had sold defective iron to the Navy, and they were actually brought up on charges for it. And this guy named Philander Knox had defended them in this scandalous lawsuit.
That's a horrible name. Philander.
Yeah, right. Philander Knox. Well, that's his name. P.H., Philander. At any rate, they then tried to get him to up for a Supreme Court member, and then they talked him out of becoming a Supreme Court justice because they wanted and needed him to be a Secretary of State so that they could get an amendment through to overrule the ruling of this Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust case, so that they could then manage to get through an unconstitutional direct unapportioned income tax. And that's how the 16th Amendment, which, you know, the law of never was, is, of course, shows all the certified documents proving that the 16th Amendment was never properly ratified by 3/4 right. of the states. But Philander Knox took all sorts of illegal, and even in cases where the 16th was rejected, and like to give you an example, in Oklahoma, they rewrote the 16th Amendment to mean exactly the opposite of what it was, then approved that, and then sent that in, and Philander Knox deemed it a ratification of the 16th Amendment. And there's all sorts of examples of that, but the point is that without a corrupt Secretary of State to fraudulently certify that ratification, the 16th Amendment would never have been ratified. Well, then they go to the and they really were justifying, the reason they did that was because they had already voted through the Federal Reserve Act, and they needed a way to collect these unlawful taxes in order to pay the interest due to the fraudulent debt that was then due to the owners, these private bankster owners of the Federal Reserve. Well, in the 1930s, Alfred Lawson wrote about this, and I've got to read this. I think it's so perfect. It's right on. Alfred Lawson. Red, do you want to give a little history of who Alfred Lawson was?
Well, he was an American hero at that point in time. He was publishing the largest circulation newspaper in the world at that time, called The Benefactor. And he held most of the airplane patents for several years, a number of years. It was his planes that were flying the first airmail and flying the first passengers and that type of thing. And so he was well known, and he published this newspaper because he was trying to alert his fellow Americans to the dangers that they faced. And you've got it there, a copy of some of it, so I'll let you read it.
Okay, this was published in The Benefactor. And so not only was he an entrepreneur, but he was an inventor, and he was a publisher, and he was very, very well known. And he wrote in this speech, he said, "My job now is to show how a little bunch of alien financiers are stealing America, how they are going to enslave the American people, and how illiteracy will be reestablished so that the children of these swindlers can drive American children to work like beasts in the field. If you are satisfied to have these international thieves steal the United States of America, take your homes, farms, stores, manufacturing plants, railroads, airlines, newspapers, radios, every bit of the wealth you have in this country away from you, then everything is all right. If you are not willing that these alien rogues steal America, make you and your children slaves, then everything is all wrong. But it is up to you, the people, to say whether everything is all right or whether everything is all wrong. It is up to me to tell you that it is all wrong, because you have no way to find out what it is all about unless I tell you. And thank you, Red Beckman, for giving me that excerpt the other day. Now, is that more applicable today or what?
It's amazingly applicable today.
It's a point that I want to get across on these DVDs that we're going to be putting out, how that we have had voices in the past who have spoke out. Of course, Congressman Lindbergh in 1913 speaking out against the Federal Reserve, and people didn't listen. Then, of course, we had Father Coughlin on the radio in the 30s. And Alfred Lawson, these people all knew that we were in trouble, and they tried to tell the American people that we were in trouble. And so we've got to get across to the Tea Party people and the people that are listening now, because their hearing is better. They've lost their homes and lost their jobs and all of that, and so their hearing is much better today, and we have a better audience for our message. But we need to get the Tea Party people to understand that they don't have to go back and reinvent the wheel. They don't have to dig into every small detail and everything, because it's already been done. And they just need to pick up where Alfred Lawson and Vivian Kellam, the first real tax protester in the 1940s. There was just a lot of people back there. And now we're in trouble in this country. Well, I said it 25 years ago. I said people would say, how long is it going to take before we can get our country back, before we can get this thing done? And I used to tell them, well, it's going to take an economic meltdown. When we have that, then the people are going to listen to what we're saying, and then we can make something happen. And so that's what this program is all about, is that we make things happen. We learn how to make things happen, and we try to do that, and it's just been worth a great deal to have Jay on here tonight, because he's second generation. And that thrills me to death. I've got a couple of sons, and they know what I'm doing, and they pick up on it pretty strong, but they don't really get involved. And that saddens me, of course, because I'd like to have a son that would step into my shoes. And Alan Stang Sr., he's got a son that's stepping into his shoes, and I'll tell you, that's such a fantastic thing for me to hear that. And so I probably won't say any more here, but I sure thank you for coming on, Alan, or Jay.
Thanks, Red. It's my pleasure. Getting back to what you were saying about what it's going to take to get our country back, recently, after I speak at events, people come up to me and say, why aren't more people involved? Why aren't more people active? And I say that everything in life, human beings especially, operate off of stress. Stress, it takes many forms. When you go to the gym and you lift a bunch of weights, that doesn't make you stronger. That tears your muscle fibers and puts stress on your muscles. And then when you sleep that night, your body repairs itself. But you're not going to repair, your body doesn't repair itself unless you've put it under stress of 250 pounds on a bench press. And so if you look at stress of the economic variety, it's the same thing. People aren't going to get involved while their lives are cushy and comfortable and they've got 500 channels of movies on the satellite TV. People are really only going to get involved when their economic livelihood and vitality is threatened. Then the wife says, get off the couch and go do something about it. Or men realize that they actually have to do something, that this isn't just a wild-eyed, paranoid fantasy, but this is really happening. It's going to take things to get a lot worse before people realize that we can't raise the debt limit, that we can't raise it, and then we can't accept any compromises or half truths or promises that have been broken time and time again. And they have to realize that all these things like Social Security, Medicare, and all these different programs, entitlements, are unsustainable. I spoke at the Southeast Texas Tea Party Tax Day rally on April 18th. And to their credit, the crowd was composed, more than half of the crowd were probably senior citizens. But nobody rushed the stage when I said that Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security were unconstitutional. Nobody threw any tomatoes or anything at me. So I was pretty surprised by that, because I think one of the blind spots in a lot of Tea Party people is they say, leave my Medicare alone, which is just a completely nonsensical thing to say. Let's cut the budget, but don't you dare touch my Medicare. So it's going to have to get a lot worse before people, massive amounts of people, really get off their rear ends and do something. In the meantime, the people that have the amazing blessing to be able to see what's going on, we have to keep doing our work. As John Adams said, the duty is ours, the results are God's. So as long as we're doing what we're supposed to do, you can take comfort in that you're doing the right thing, and nobody can ask anything more of you than your best. And then when everybody else comes to the party late, you can't say, how come you weren't with me 5 years ago? You just have to welcome them to the party and just recognize that that's human nature.
Are you familiar at all with what BRICS means, B-R-I-C-S, that group of countries? Red, are you all right?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Yep.
That's not me.
Jay, have you heard of BRICS, B-R-I-C-S?
Hold on, choked on somebody's seat.
Well, the BRICS group,
I apologize for that. I was taking a drink of iced tea and went down the wrong tube.
Oh, no problem. I'll cover here for a second. BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South America.
Right.
They have meetings together and plan what they're going to do now. And one of the things that they've done is they have stopped trading with each other in what's known as dollars, or the Federal Reserve notes, really,
right.
Fiat paper notes that they've been using as the reserve currency.
Mm-hmm.
And that group has now stopped trading in dollars. And what we're seeing is even shop owners in Mexico are no longer taking these Federal Reserve notes for their product. They won't even take an American currency for it.
I've read about that. I think it's an interesting development, and you can think about a couple different reasons for them doing that. One reason is they're tying in with Brazil and South America as a large trading partner. Then maybe the other reason is the Mexican government can actually see the instability of the dollar and does not want to be, exposed in investment terms, exposed to a lot of losses when the dollar craters.
Well, and the IMF has the gall to suggest that they want to exchange these what they call drawing rights,
right,
as the reserve currency, and of course that means that they want to take a basket of for the most part fiat currencies and use that basket of currency to value these drawing rights.
Right.
So it's going to be a fiat valued based on a basket of fiat.
Well, Terry, is there any country in the world that does not use a fiat currency? I'm not aware of any.
Well, actually, it's my understanding that the European Union, the euro, is partially backed by gold, something like 40% backed by gold. But you see, being backed by something doesn't change the banking theft that's going on.
Right. See, as long as you have fractional reserve banking, you can still cause a lot of problems.
As long as a bank can create money out of thin air,
right,
by monetizing debt, they're still going to be able to create these inflationary and deflationary swings, which is exactly
worse, Terry. If you're some percentage of backed by gold, it's worse because you're giving people the false comfort that your currency is backed by gold, and so they will buy into the charade longer than they would normally. I think in America's Great Depression, Murray Rothbard makes that case that the Federal Reserve caused the Great Depression by inflating the money supply 68% over the gold holdings over the course of the 1920s, which is why they were called the Roaring Twenties. The fiat currency flooding the system it was one of the first bubbles. So, yeah, as long as you can create money, even if it's backed by gold, you have the ability to cause a lot of damage.
It would be a good idea if everybody watched the markets and watched the price of silver. Gold, too, but I prefer to watch the price of silver. And today, it would have taken at least 46 $1 Federal Reserve notes to buy an ounce of silver.
Yes, amazing.
And silver, I talked to a dealer today, and he is just absolutely swamped with orders. And he's buying it wherever he can buy it, and he has to pay a premium. He has to sell it with a premium. In other words, over the spot price. And here, a week or two ago, he told me, he said that the silver market was going to break the $50 market probably by the 1st of June. Today, he told me, I think it'll break the $50 mark before the 1st of May, because it flirted with $47 today. And this is something that it brings up two questions. Are people buying that silver because they believe that it would be a good hedge, or are they considering silver as the better place to put those phony Federal Reserve notes they have, because they see where at some point that Federal Reserve note is going to be worthless? And so I suspicion that most of the market today is people that are they're holding a bunch of Federal Reserve notes, and they have woke up to what's happening, and they're trying to get into something, into a hard asset, as quickly as they can. Because I told that dealer, I said, you know, it's awfully strange. When silver's cheap, nobody was buying all that much of it. Now, when it's high, you are busier than you've ever been. And like I say, there's a couple of questions. Are they buying it just to have that silver hedge when this thing goes, or are they, and it's probably partially both. People with a large quantity of Federal Reserve notes, they see the end coming, and they want to get out of them.
Well, we've got a caller, but let me address that real quick before we open up the line to caller 208. We're going to get you on here in just a second, so don't hang up on us. Silver, historically, the ratio between silver and gold, or gold to silver, has historically been between 16 and 17. That means that the price of gold historically is 16 to 17 times as high as silver. Well, silver then, based on the price of gold, is cheap. Right now, even at 46, 47 that it closed at today, it's still cheap. Well, think about it. That means that, let's look at the 17 to 1 ratio. Then if gold hits 1,700, silver should be 100. And I certainly believe that gold is going to go to at least 1,700, maybe at 2,500. So it's very reasonable to believe that silver is going to approach $100 in value. Now,
I believe that's going to happen too.
Let me let me just clarify what I mean by that value. The problem we've got is that we keep relating the value of any commodity to the price of a Federal Reserve note. And that's a fallacy because there is no intrinsic value in that Federal Reserve note. So as these prices are going up, it's not the intrinsic value of these commodities that is going up. It is the value of the paper that the Federal Reserve note, it's approaching its true intrinsic value, which is zero, really, effectively. So people, I wish we could get the people in the financial community to explain to us how they get the word out on this kind of stuff. I mean, they spend a lot of advertising dollars, obviously, because they make a lot of money off of selling stuff. But we need to be able to educate people that they need to judge the law and that they need to recognize how their unalienable rights are being stolen by these, you know, pirates, really, that we've got running our government. We need to get people as educated in the same way about that as they are on financial issues. People understand that gold and silver is going to go up in value as the dollar loses its value. So that they are buying it for a hedge, and they're buying more silver because they recognize that historic ratio still makes the price of silver low. Can we open up the phone lines? 208, are you there? I'm sure you're going to be unmuted in a second if you're not. Say hello, 208. You are open. Area code 208. Please speak up. You have an open mic, area code 208. Well, your last numbers are 3488, if that's any help. All right, well, I guess we'll just continue the discussion, and if they decide to speak, they'll introduce themselves.
I think stockbrokers are a little too interested in keeping people in on the game. It seems like the stock market exists on new money coming into it, and stockbrokers and 401k people have to keep the supply coming in. And the reason I say that is a couple years ago at my last company, I don't know what his technical name is, but he came in to talk to everybody in my company about signing up for a 401k. And the example he used was if you had put $72,000, and if you had invested it in 1972, and then if you kept in the stock market until 2005, you would get approximately $250,000. So he said, see, it's really great. The stock market historically always makes you money, and you should invest with us. So afterwards, I said, well, here's the problem I have with this scenario. In 1972, 72,000 probably would buy you 9 or 10 Cadillacs. I think Cadillacs cost $6,000 or $7,000 back then. But if you take that $250,000 in 2005, you might be able to buy 5 Cadillacs with that same amount of money. So I said, what's the deal? Is you're getting more money, but the purchasing power is declining. So that $72,000 bought a lot more than $250,000 does today. And the expression on his face was pretty funny. It's like, how did you figure that out? And so I said, why don't you tell people that? He says, well, because no one will understand it. And so people like you that do understand it, you know, we have to market to, you know, the mass majority of people. I said, you know, it's too bad that you underestimate the intelligence of the people in this room, because everybody in here is either a technician, an engineer, a designer, or some kind of technical occupation, and we deal with pretty intelligent stuff all the time. So he started to backtrack. You know, he never was going to let people in on what's behind the curtain, that sure, you invest your money with us, but your money's losing value all the time, and he's not going to let you know unless you call him out on it. So I don't think stockbrokers have an incentive to letting people know the truth. They're busy. They're a little too busy keeping the game going. If there are any stockbrokers listening in that disagree, please call up and disagree with me. I'd love to hear an opposing opinion.
Well, Jay, let me. We've got about 10 minutes left. Let me make a confession. I've made some of this confession on some of the other previous shows in last weeks. But we had Pat Shannon, who's a assistant editor for American Free Press, on, and a personal friend of Red's. And in his book, Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie, he's got a definition in there of red, white, and blue fever.
Okay.
And I believe we've all, most of us, have to some extent had that red, white, and blue fever. I've been a real estate broker and developer most of my life. And frankly, I've also been a victim of red, white, and blue fever. I voted for W.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it hasn't been that long ago.
Right.
You know, today, if I, you know, knowing what I know today, I wouldn't do that. It was painful for me to vote for McCain.
Yeah.
I didn't want to vote for McCain, but I didn't really have any choice but to vote for McCain.
I voted for Chuck Baldwin, but if I didn't vote for Chuck Baldwin, I would have voted for Obama.
Well, here's my point. Being a real estate broker, I believe that real estate was a great investment.
Yes.
And I propped that attitude up because it was somewhat to my personal benefit to prop that attitude up because, you know, as long as the expansion continued and the inflation continued, then real estate was a good investment.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see really very far in advance what was coming. And when I did see it coming, I thought it was going to be temporary.
Right.
Well, now I know better.
Well, you know, real estate
and,
is.
And my eyes are open. And because I've got a good conscience and I want to serve God's will, not just my own pocketbook, it really turned me around. I really had a lot of trouble being a good real estate broker. Now, God's changed my heart on this. I now recognize that it is what I know. It is what I do well. It's what I have expertise at, and it's what I need to continue working on.
Right.
Because people do need to own their property. They do need a dwelling. They do need a forced manner of savings. It is a commodity, just like anything else, which is another way to protect yourself to some extent against the crashing of that paper fiat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I can help people also get out of bad situations by negotiating with the banks and getting short sales and that sort of thing. There's actually some good to be done for people who are in these financial binds. And I don't have to be out there just selling them on the fact that the value on that property is going to continue going
right.
up because it always has. So
mm-hmm.
So God showed me a different way to use my expertise and serve his will. But for a long time, I had red, white, and blue fever. And
It's hard not to get it. It really is.
So, you know, I want people to understand that this is a problem. You know,
yep.
I try to, you know, even look at the people right now, and I don't want to offend any of my friends that are listening, especially our host. But look at the way people are hanging their hat on Donald Trump because he's out there talking about the birth certificate.
Yeah.
To some extent, yeah. That's red, white, and blue fever. It's warning. It's warning what he's talking about to come true. So bad that you're willing to hang your hat on somebody that supports universal health care, and has been an advocate for gay marriage and abortion and everything else in the past. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden it's convenient for him to change his tune. So, but he is doing us a service. I mean, I think it's going to blow up in our face eventually, because I think he's going to try to split the vote, the conservative vote, and help whoever gets the Democratic nomination. And Kate, you can come on and argue with me for the next 6 or 7 minutes if you want to. but you know, I see this as a real problem, and we've got to get over this. We've got to get over this fact that we are addicted to believing lies. And Red's taught me about this. And Red, I'll shut up and let you talk about that for a couple of minutes.
Well, I wrote that little book, The Walls in Our Minds. And basically, The position that the world is in tonight is because of all the lies that have been given out by been given out by politicians and bankers and such, and even preachers in our pulpits. And people have believed a lot of misinformation, disinformation. They just believed a lot of lies, and it's we're paying a tremendous price for that today. And so this is what we've got to get across to the Tea Parties. They've got to come to terms with the fact that they were lied to in the government school system.
Yep.
They have been lied to in the government church system. They've been lied to with the from the government media. And they've got to just kind of clean the slate if they can and say, hey, I'm not going to operate in any way with anything that has been told me by these politicians, newsmen, preachers, and such. I'm not going to believe anything they say. I've got to find out for myself. And so that's where we come into the picture, is that we must try our best to put the truth out there in a form that that they will accept. The truth has to go out there in a form that they will recognize as truth. And then they want more truth, and we have to be there to help them out and get them over the rough spots, because there's going to be a lot of rough spots coming up here right shortly. Part of the thing that I had today, Morgan Stanley is a bank on Wall Street, and they may well go down here very shortly. They've been playing games with the silver market, and now they've got about, I think they said, 5,000 contracts. And when these people come in and want their silver, Morgan Stanley, if they don't have it, they've got to go out and buy it at the market price, and it's going to put them out of business. It's momentarily. It's not too far out there in the future. It's going to happen fairly shortly. So with that, I'll shut up.
Sorry about that.
No, Jay, we've got about 2.5 minutes left, and I'm just going to let you close out with whatever you'd like to say.
Well, I think Red was talking about people stopping believing lies. And I think in this next election cycle, you're going to see another display of the dialectic in action. The antithesis is Obama, and the thesis will be Herman Cain. And people will run towards Herman Cain because they want to support a black guy who's actually an American and is conservative. And so that person for this cycle is Herman Cain. But you know, I feel like I have to shout this from the rooftops. Herman Cain is courting the Tea Parties actively right now, but only 3 years ago, Herman Cain was writing in favor of the TARP, saying if we don't accept a $700 billion haircut now, we're going to have to accept a $700 trillion haircut later. And he said anybody who opposed the TARP is nothing but a free market purist, and that's aimed specifically at the Tea Parties. But now 3 years later, he's talking to them about what a great guy he is and why he wants their vote, and he's hoping that no one read those two obscure little articles he wrote. And not to mention that even more damning is that Herman Cain in the 90s was the president of the Kansas City Fed. He's a complete snake in the grass, and you know, if people don't realize that, they're going to get led down by the Pied Piper once again. People need to wake up and realize that Herman Cain is not a conservative, and they need to tell all their friends and research him for themselves so they can learn the truth.
He's an ex-government employee, and he is tied to the globalist. And
he's also on the North American Competitive Council, which is part of the Security and Prosperity Partnership, which, for the people listening in Texas, means that Herman Cain was one of the big backers of the Trans-Texas Corridor, which is not a very popular topic in Texas.
So he's a cohort of Bilderberg Perry.
he's another fraud, and people need to know that.
We have 50 seconds, and if you guys don't mind, I'd like to close us out with a prayer because we forgot to do that at the beginning. Thank you so much tonight, Jay, for coming on and joining us. You've been a wonderful guest, and we want to have you back anytime you're ready. So you just let us know.
My pleasure.
You got something to say. You got something to say. You're welcome to come on. Almighty God, thank you for this night. Thank you for Jay. Thank you for Red. We pray that your healing hand is on Red, and you keep him healthy for us. We need him around. He's our great teacher, and we thank you, Father, for providing that teaching to us. We're just thankful for your spirit and thankful for your son. As always, in the name of Yeshua, we pray. Amen. And we'll see everyone next week, next Thursday night, on Walls in Our Minds. Good night, Red.
Unborn children see light of day. What is the light?